Hello and welcome one and all to episode 13, lucky number 13 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast in Society. I'm Jerry Shario, and I would like to introduce to you a man who always wanted to be somebody, but now realizes he should have been more specific, Nick Santamaria.
I used to live near the Pacific, but now I'm on the East Coast and I swim in the Atlantic. But you know, thank you for that lovely introduction.
Growing up in Boston, I could never get used to the fact when I was living in California that the ocean was on the wrong side. Really.
It's like driving in England, you know?
Yes.
There's something off about this, you know? But thank God for the oceans, because for someone like me, the GPS was invented for me. The ocean told me west, you know, when I was in California, it told me west. That's the direction. So it helped me. It helped me a lot. And it helps me here too. And I live right on the beach. So there's very little east here without getting your bell bottoms wet.
There's nothing worse than wet bell bottoms.
Thank you, Professor. That was Professor Dunglack, who is in every so often to explain things.
Thank you.
That's okay. All right. So we're moving on.
Oh, we're off to a great start. Okay.
All right. I'm trying to lighten things up because we have to go to some dark places today.
Yes.
It's not for nothing that today is number 13, podcast number 13, yeah. Because this was the bad luck time for our boys, our two boys. And I'm going to say two boys because Bud also was forced really into a year-long rest. Yep. A year-long, retirement due to his partner's illness. Now, we talked about this, their schedules, and how insane they were up to this point. Universal was making them make 18 movies a year, so they never got a break. And when they did get a break, they went and gave their all for Uncle Sam. And once they got back, Universal said, another movie. We're making another movie. And sure enough, they made another movie. And then they made another movie. It's insane. Now, this is on top of their radio work, their nightclub work, their personal appearance work. I mean,
wow.
Insanity. Just insanity. Yeah. So poor Lou, at this point, they finished making Hit the Ice. And Lou collapses. He collapses. He has rheumatic fever. Now, there's a gentleman by the name of Milt Bronson, who was very important to Abbott and Costello. He was a friend from Burlesque, and he eventually became like the dialogue director on their films and the television show. He even appears in this film. He's in the Susquehanna Hat Company sequence, but he saved Lou's life. As soon as Lou showed signs of collapsing, he made him lay down and he put hot compresses on his legs. And the doctor said that may have saved his life. So this is rheumatic fever, and the only cure for it is absolute rest, and I mean bed rest. The wonderful boys at Universal made Lou a bed that could be moved from room to room, and even outside so he could sit by the pool. So they were there for him.
Wow.
And Buddy Boy came every day to visit his partner and to reassure him that he was not going to work without him. And he should not worry at all about work. He was waiting. And that gave Lou a lot of confidence. He also, during this time, while he was convalescing, he got visits from people like Clark Gable, who came and helped out financially because they were talking about starting a fund for rheumatic children who couldn't afford treatment. Mm-hmm. And Bud was in on this too. So Clark wanted to get in on it as well. He heard about it and came over. Well, frankly, I'd like to help. The biggest thrill for Lou at this time was a visit from his hero. And if you are a comedy fan, you would probably faint dead away when Charlie Chaplin knocks on your door. Charlie was there. They had a great time. They took some wonderful pictures together. Charlie talked to Lou about doing a remake of The Kid starring Lou.
Wow.
Yeah, could you imagine? And then Charlie did tell the press that Lou Costello was the best comic working in films. And so say all of us. Mm-hmm. So Lou is convalescing. Now, the good side to this is that had he not been ill, had he not been struck down at this point and forced to be home and in bed, he would not have gotten to know his son. he would have gone on, you know, doing the Universal schedule, and, you know, he probably would have seen him in between gigs. But at this point, the two of them, first of all, Butch, little Lou Jr., mm-hmm. was the dream of his life. They already had two lovely girls. They had Patty and Carol, mm-hmm. and Lou wanted a boy. More than anything, he wanted a boy, and he got it. He got his little boy. And because he was home, he got to watch him grow up. That first year, that wonderful first year of having a child. And on top of everything else, they learned to walk together. Can you believe? I mean, it really was a gift, I have to say. But wow. Gifts come at a price. And when I thought about writing this one chapter in our book, The Annotated Abbott and Costello, I made such a fuss all through the book about my affinity for Lou Costello and how he changed my life when I was a child and how he was maybe the most influential person in my career life. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't understand how this guy could, the day his baby died, he went on and worked. He told his beautiful Anne to leave the baby awake to see if he recognized his daddy's voice on the radio. And this was an eagerly anticipated radio show. Lou had been away for a year. And now Bud and Lou were coming back for the first time. People tried to fill in, Mickey Rooney, Red Skelton, you know, they all called in and said, we'll be happy to take over for you until you're well. But Bud said, no, you get well and we'll come back together. Well, that day, Lou went to the radio station and got the dreaded phone call that his baby had somehow gotten out of his playpen. He was by the pool and he crawled into the swimming pool and drowned. This news was given to Lou. He rushed back home to find nothing but, you know, sadness and craziness. They were trying to revive the baby and they couldn't. And Lou told Anne, I'm going to do the job. I'm going to do the show. I told my baby that I wanted him to hear my voice, and wherever he is, I want him to hear it. It's a horrible, horrible story. Now, I'd like to read a little bit about Lou and how I feel about this and what he did and, mm-hmm. you know, just how amazing it is. Let's not forget little Butch. For any parent to lose a child is the worst thing that could possibly happen. The pain must have been unbearable. To that end, the very fact that Lou went ahead and did their radio show on the same day that his beloved boy passed away says everything I need to know about the man. Sometimes I forget that in his early life, he was a boxer with a very decent record. That takes an enormous amount of strength and confidence. For a small man, he was very strong, macho, and extremely driven. When he auditioned for his first burlesque job in 1929, he was only 23 years old, with no stage experience. Not only did he land the job, but that very same year he was getting standout mentions in the reviews. Any parent who could function as Lou did at a time like that must have had the strength that is born of the streets. On the streets, one learns to shake it off and keep going. And so he did. He carried on, making us laugh in spite of the enormous pain he must have felt every single day. And I have nothing but sympathy for Lou's wife, Anne Costello. Butch's accident happened on her watch, and I'm sure that Lou and his mother would occasionally cast an accusing eye at the poor woman. Her feelings of guilt and pain must have been too agonizing to deal with. Although I was taken aback when I'd read that she'd passed away only a few months after Lou did, at the very young age of 47, I now completely understand. Her journey was hurried along by drink, but I believe it was the awful pain in a mother's heart that was the main culprit. By all accounts, she worshipped her husband, and this wedge must have been terribly debilitating. So that's what I wrote in the book about it, and
wow.
He did the show, and the writers prepared this for Bud. I'm sure he felt every word. And this was what the audience heard at the end of that show.
And now here's Bud Abbott with a final word.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, now that our program is over and we have done our best to entertain you, I would like to take a moment to pay tribute to my best friend and to a man who has more courage than I have ever seen displayed in the theater. Tonight, the old expression, the show must go on, was brought home to all of us on this program, more clearly than ever before. Just a short time before our broadcast started, Lou Costello was told that his baby, one-year-old Tamara, had died. In the face of the greatest tragedy which can come to any man, Luke Costello went on tonight so that you, the radio audience, would not be disappointed. There's nothing more that I can say except that I know you all join me in expressing our deepest sympathy to a great trooper. Good night. This is the National Broadcast.
So, buddy boy, very good, very nice, and what a horrible, horrible thing to experience. So, Universal had their next film all set. It was a story by two of Jack Benny's ex-writers, Hugh Wedlock and Howard Snyder. They came up with the story. They gave it to first-time producer Edmund Hartman, who was a writer up to that point, still a writer. He worked on this one with the ubiquitous John Grant and uncredited the great Clyde Bruckman, who we'll talk about a little bit later, another tragic story. But Alex Gottlieb, we talked last week, that was his last time with the boys until the 1950s. I understand that he retained his friendship with Lou Costello through all of these years until they worked together again in the 1950s. This was a first-time director, and Abbott and Costello fans will recognize the name of Gene Yarborough, who went on to produce and direct their film television show, The Abbott and Costello Show. He was a very B-movie director, I have to say. It's said that he had very little sense of humor, which, let's face it, Jerry, when you come to Abbott and Costello, they just want directors that get out of the way.
Yes.
And let them do their thing. So that's perfect. It's kind of like the Marx Brothers with Norman Z. McCloud.
Yeah.
Here was a guy who just said, okay, go. That's great. You know, didn't try to inflict any messages or any, you know, any of his style. Mm-hmm. So he let the boys go, which was much appreciated by fans as well. So we have Gene Yarborough, first time director. And this has a few Marx Brother parallels in this film, starting with where the mansion was. And that was the Jewett estate in Pasadena. And I don't know if you recognized it, but that was the estate Margaret Dumont's in Duck Soup.
Yes.
Yeah, where the Trentino proposes to her and Groucho slips in. So that was one thing. The other thing is one of the writers, and this was credited, his name is Hal Finberg. Now, Hal Finberg has a Marx Brother thing and a Ritz Brother thing. He used to write special material for the Ritz Brothers, some of their best stuff. And he also wrote on The Big Store for the Marx Brothers, even helping to write Sing While You Sell. Sing While You Sell. I'm one of those people that loves The Big Store. It's my second favorite of their MGM movies behind A Night at the Opera. Oh, yeah. A Day at the Races is a big snore rather than The Big Store.
Yeah.
it goes on way too long. And it's just not.
Yes.
You know, and it has a few good set scenes, a few good comedy scenes, but it doesn't do it for me. And At the Circus, mediocre. Go West, their worst. So The Big Store, to me, you know, they're back. Okay, so Hal Finberg is here. And so that's another Marx Brother thing. So we had the mansion. We had Hal Finberg, one of the writers. And there was one other thing. Oh, yes. The animal crackers. Similarities. Jerry, go ahead. You go ahead with this.
Oh my gosh, yes. Margaret Irving, who plays a wonderful role in this film, not too dissimilar from the one she played in Animal Crackers.
13 years earlier.
Exactly. Talk about typecast, my goodness. But yeah, it was interesting to see her. It's fun to see her in this one, because quite honestly, I can't recall seeing her in anything else between these two.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Because I feel that way, too. I don't remember her from anything other than these two movies.
Yeah.
And even when I was a kid, I recognized her from Animal Crackers. Mm-hmm. And not even seeing the movie Animal Crackers, just seeing the stills, because it wasn't available. But I recognized the name, and she pretty much looks the same. Her hair is a little grayer, but she looks the same. But she's playing the exact same role. She's playing a rival society matron who has a young daughter, you know, in Animal Crackers, it was a young friend. and they're looking to humiliate, you know, their rival. So she's playing the same exact role. And I'll tell you, she is so good with Abbott and Costello. Yes. That whole scene where they talk about the plunger, mm-hmm. and Lou thinks she's talking about a plumbing instrument. Anyway, we'll get around to all that. You'll know what we're talking about in a minute. So anyway, so those are the Marx Brothers parallels. So here's a very, very nice thing about MGM. We don't say many nice things about MGM, but in this case, they really, really went out of their way to be decent people. This was not the next movie that Abbott and Costello filmed. They had already filmed Lost in a Harem for MGM, their second MGM film.
Oh.
But since the boys were away for a year and the public was used to seeing 19,000 Abbott and Costello movies, they wanted to be the first ones back. And MGM already had a finished film waiting to be released. Yeah. They told them that they would wait until Universal released In Society, and then they released Lost in a Harem. So you got to really give them credit for that. That was a very kind thing to do. And the opening titles reflect that, because you see, first of all, the great Universal logo, my favorite of all time. Mm-hmm. And then you see Universal Presents, and their names come up really big. Bud Abbott and Lou Costello. And both of their heads come up in the O's in their names.
Yes.
And they look up, they see themselves, they blanch, and it goes into the regular opening credits. And it's just a great way to welcome them back. Lou looks great, by the way. I know he's been through hell. Did you notice in this movie how energetic? Okay, this is something I really need to talk about. And Matthew Conium brings it up in the book. A lot of people say that there is a fine line splitting Lou Costello's performances. There's, you know, the movies he did before his son passed away, and then the ones after. And they say that the movies after are different. He's different. He's not as lively. He's not as childlike. He's not as spontaneous or whatever. Matthew says it's almost as if he's more mechanical in that case. But he also says that when we were kids watching these movies, when we were growing up on these films, I didn't notice any difference at all.
Yeah.
Lou was still energetic. He was still hilarious. He was still doing great falls. He was still yelling and screaming and making great noises. You know, he was the trooper of all time.
Yeah.
And I have to say that, okay, there might be a difference, but there was also a difference in the films. People forget that when Universal started looking in different directions for the team, because of the reviews coming out were saying Universal is doing the best comedians working. They're doing them dirt. They're giving them material that we've seen. It's all the same stuff, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, so so this one comes up, and the reviews said a lot of that. It said, you know, the boys need better material. I kind of really like this movie. I mean, it's not, I don't think it's quite up to Hit the Ice, but boy, it's close. It's really close.
Mm-hmm.
They're incredible. Their energy. Yeah. Do you?
Yeah. I do.
Did you notice Bud's energy in this movie specifically?
Yes.
He makes Mo Howard look like Albert Schweitzer. I'm serious. He's brutal. He's just brutal on Lou.
And, you know, it's almost as if the year off revitalized him just as much as it did Lou.
That's exactly what I was thinking last night as I was watching the movie. He must have been like a racehorse at the gate, you know, waiting for the gate to open. But boy, there's some slaps in this movie that you know, they probably heard on the other side of the world. And I'm thinking, poor, you know, God, give him a break. You know, he's been through hell. But anyway, so they're back and they're lively and whatever.
Yeah.
Now, Edmund Hartman did some later interviews, and I don't know why this happens. Just like Bob Thomas writing that horrible book about Bud and Lou, listening to their manager, Eddie Sherman, who obviously had, you know, a bone to pick with the boys. Some of these guys that worked with Bud and Lou are telling stories out of school. It's like Edmund Hartman is telling a story about Lou Costello approaching him before the movie, before they're shooting. And he says, under no uncertain terms, okay, Bud and I are in at 10 o'clock in the morning and we're out at 3 o'clock. I don't care if you're shooting a scene and we hear it's 3 o'clock, we are walking out at 3 o'clock. So you just better get what you need. We're only doing one take. You don't get it. That's your problem, not ours. And that's it. This is what Edmund Hartman reported in an interview. My good buddy, Matthew Conium, did the research, looked up the studio log. Mm-hmm. For the 32 days that they shot this film, Abbott and Costello left at 3 o'clock, 9 of those days. Half of them were scheduled. Wow. So Edmund Hartman, eat me, okay? I'm really tired of that bull. You know, it's like between Edmund Hartman and Eddie Sherman and Bob Thomas and all those idiots, you know, it's like, get real. The man was a hero, as far as I'm concerned. Lou was a hero. Going on the way he did. So the movie begins after those wonderful opening titles, and we are at the Van Cleve mansion. The butler, William Davidson, who is did a time as Moose Mattson in Hold That Ghost and as the carnival guy in Keep 'Em Flying. We love William Davidson. And he's the butler in this, which is kind of unusual for him. Yeah. He's usually kind of rough hewn, you know, kind of rough and tumble.
Yeah.
And the other butler is Charles Coleman, who is a butler for his entire career. Funny, funny guy. And Thurston Hall comes home. Mr. Van Cleve comes home from a business trip. Wink, wink. And he's probably out with that blonde. He was at the restaurant, you know, in Hold That Ghost.
There you go.
But anyway, so he doesn't want to be bothered. He wants to go to bed. He's tired. I hate costume parties. And he goes upstairs. He goes upstairs and there's a drip in his faucet. Now, that's not a euphemism for something dirty. It just means that there's water dripping out of his water faucet in his bathroom, which is attached to their master bedroom. So he gets up and he tells the butler to call a plumber because he'll never sleep with that drip. I've heard that before in my life, by the way, too. I'll never sleep with that drip.
Okay.
But you know, your wives are funny. So this is so funny. This is how they introduce Lou. Bud and Lou are plumbers. They're with the Ajax Plumbing Company. They own it, by the way. And Bud is sitting there comfortably reading a magazine while the phone is ringing. And he said, Albert, answer the phone. So Lou comes down a fireman's pole upside down and hits his head on the concrete. Bud is immediately sympathetic and says, what are you trying to do? Break the concrete. So Lou answers the phone and the butler asks what they charge. And he says, $6 an hour. And the butler is like, what are the? And he goes, oh, is that too expensive? Well, maybe you can call another company. I know a cheaper company. Call the Atlas Company. And it's weird because he pronounces it Atlas.
Yeah.
And I think he's doing it just to try to be funny, but it's weird. So he hangs up and another phone rings and he answers it, Atlas Plumbing. What? They're charging you $6? Oh, those crap. We charge $4. And it's like, they get the job, of course, undercutting themselves. Very clever. Yeah. So
I got to say, my favorite line in this, probably the entire movie, comes when he answers that first phone call with their plumbing company slogan. We stand behind every bathtub we sell. I don't know why, but that tickles me every time I hear it.
It is funny. It really is funny. And it's that variation on Miracle Productions. If it's a good movie, it's a miracle.
Yes.
So, you know, some people have made some interesting comparisons. This scene, first of all, we both know it from Knights of the Bath from Castle Films, right?
Yes. That was the first reel that I, when I purchased my sound movie projector back in 1970. Blah, blah, blah,
blah. Now, was that Super 8 sound? Super 8?
Yes, Super 8 sound.
I had one too.
I still have it.
Oh my God.
I've just recently purchased a new projector because I couldn't get the old one fixed anywhere. No one would even look at it. So I got a new used projector and I still have that reel. And that was the one that I used to test the new projector, you know, because it was the first one and it's, you know, tradition. But anyway, yes, it is just so well put together, that reel. And it's if Abbott and Costello had made short subjects, this would have been it.
That would have been it. That's what people say, that this is the closest they ever came to the Stooges, but for me, they go beyond. They go beyond the Stooges. Number one, they've got the budget that the Stooges never had, you know, and the movie was, this was their most expensive film, by the way, up to this point. Yeah. It was almost $700,000, to make this film. But, they were the most Stooge-like during this sequence, and it is rough and tumble. It is like crazy. Bud is like, he's like beside himself. It's like, someone injected with a syringe, juice from Lon Chaney Jr., you know, into his veins. Because boy, those slaps, him pushing his head into the hole where the water's coming out. Put your head in it. Put your head in it. Oh my God.
Well, it just makes me wonder how much of an influence Clyde Bruckman was in that sort of comparison there.
Excellent.
You know, because so much of his career was with the Stooges.
Well, this was his scene. This was the scene that he contributed to.
Yeah.
Just very quickly, for those who don't know Clyde Bruckman, I just want to give a quick overview. He was a silent movie comedian. He was a director and gag man, worked with Keaton quite a bit, co-directed and co-wrote The General of all movies, did some of the, The Stooges and all the two-reeler stuff. And it got to the point where he became an alcoholic and he started repeating himself. He started borrowing from himself. Mm. Unfortunately, he didn't own the things he wrote. He wrote them for either film companies or, you know, Harold Lloyd. You know, he wrote stuff for Movie Crazy and some of his later things. Mm-hmm. And Harold Lloyd, at this point, right around this time that this movie was made, decided that he was being stolen from. Mm-hmm. And he sued everybody. He sued Clyde Bruckman. He sued Universal. He sued Abbott and Costello. No, he didn't sue Abbott and Costello. But he sued everybody. Mm-hmm. This made Clyde Bruckman unemployable. Wow. He drank more and more. He became more and more unreliable. The only jobs he could get were with the Stooges and the Abbott and Costello TV show, where he again borrowed from himself. And eventually he borrowed Buster Keaton's pistol, saying he was going on a hunting trip with a pistol. He went to a seedy diner, went into the bathroom and blew his brains out. Wow. So I just want to say to Harold Lloyd, there's a reason why you're my least favorite of the four silent comedians, and I include Harry Langdon, who I think was funnier than you. Okay, you creep. Harold Lloyd was one of the richest people in Hollywood.
Yep.
He needed this. He needed to destroy another human being, you know, so he could feel better about himself. No, sorry. So anyway, they do this wonderful scene, this wonderful plumbing scene.
Yes.
And here's something they did that I've got to give them credit, and I'm going to give it to the writers here. Bud and Lou are doing major damage in the bathroom, trying to fix this leak. It's really quite hilarious when the plunger ends up on Bud's forehead. And Lou says, "Oh, don't worry, just keep it there. I'll tell him I got you at an auction." and then he calls him a rhinoceros later because he had the horn coming out of his forehead. But anyway, this is what the writers did. You cut away now for a song number. Okay. Mm-hmm. And you know, the entire time this song is going on, and it's a good one.
Yes.
You know that Bud and Lou are upstairs doing more damage, and you're just wondering what's going to happen. So let's go to Elsie Hammerdingle, played by Marion Hutton, Betty Hutton's little sister. And I have some information about her too. She's a cab driver, a lady cab driver, of which there were plenty during World War II, as the men were all overseas fighting. And she plays Elsie Hammerdingle. And of course, Lou is madly in love with her, you know, unrequited love. And she drives them to the mansion. So while Lou and Bud are up there doing the plumbing work, she's waiting, you know, in the lobby of the house, in the foyer. And who should show up but Peter Miller, played by Kirby Grant. He is the most eligible and richest bachelor in the world. That's how he's introduced. And he's Lou's rival. So you've got this big, good-looking, richest guy in the world against this short, fat plumber. So the poor Lou, he mistakes Elsie as a rich lady who is dressed as a cab driver at the costume party, and he doesn't believe her that she's really a cab driver. And the two of them get very close, much to the consternation of Margaret Irving and her daughter, Ann Gillis. Now, Ann Gillis was under personal contract to Lou Costello. He, in fact, before this movie was even made, he produced his own film. He wanted to keep busy. He really wanted to keep busy. So he started his own company, Biltmore Productions. He put Ann Gillis under contract to Biltmore Productions because she was going to be in this film, and loaned her to Universal, which made him money also.
Yeah.
So Lou was, he was quite a player. And she's wonderful in the movie. She really is. She's the spoiled little girl who wants Kirby Grant, but he likes Marion Hutton. So she's the third wheel in the triumvirate. Triumvirate, ooh. So the interesting thing is she's only 17 in this movie. She's still a child, basically. But she looks older. You know, yeah. she gets away with it. So anyway, Marion Hutton sings a song with Will Osborne's orchestra. And Will Osborne, originally from Canada, 1905, had a popular orchestra, not a biggie like Glenn Miller or Tommy Dorsey, but he was a drummer and a cornet player, a trombonist, played most brass instruments.
Wow.
And passed away in 1981. He retired from the music business in 1957, where he became entertainment director at one of the casinos in Lake Tahoe. So anyway, she sings a song called No Bow to Doubt It. And it's a spoonerism song, and it's no bow to doubt it, I mean no doubt about it, I'm in love with you.
No bow to doubt it, I mean no doubt about it, I'm in love with you. No bow to doubt it, I mean no doubt about it, what I say is true. You're driving me insane, my talk's effective, I jumble every line. Cause something in my brain got disconnected when your lips connected with mine. No fool I'm feeling, I mean no feel I'm fooling like a kid of two. I love you low much, I mean I love you so much, what am I to do? I feel I'll never walk straight, you got me so I just can't talk straight. No bow to doubt it, I mean no doubt about it, I'm in love with you.
So that song, I have to say, whenever I mention to Abbott and Costello fans the movie In Society, they start singing this song.
Yes, it's an incredibly catchy tune, and it's just a clever idea as well. And she sells it. She sells it beautifully.
Great. She is just great.
And I totally missed this. Another Marx Brothers connection. Marion Hutton was in Love Happy.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I forgot about that. She came back 5 years later to make the last Marx Brother movie. And she does that great song, Who Stole That Jam?
Yes.
Which was originally done at 20th Century Fox in 1938 by Alice Faye, Marjorie Weaver, and Joan Davis. Who Stole That Jam? But Marion Hutton's version in Love Happy is the one. That is just fantastic. I don't want that lollipop. Mama's going to blow her top. You stole that jam. While Harpo's running away. Anyway, Marion Hutton, their real name was Thornburg. Wasn't that a miniseries, The Thornburgs?
You're thinking of the Goldbergs.
Sorry, I was off of the gold standard. And they were raised in Battle Creek, Michigan. The father abandoned the family very early on. Mm. And the mother, in order to survive during the Depression and during Prohibition, she started a roadhouse. Their home became a roadhouse. Oh. Now, if you ever saw the old movie Babyface, the old pre-code movie with Barbara Stanwyck, that's what her dad did. They turned their apartment into a roadhouse where all the workers would come. And there's word that it doubled as a brothel. Mm. So this is where these girls were raised. They were not innocent little creatures, you know, released to the world. They were pretty well versed in the dark side. Mm-hmm. They both had time with the Vincent Lopez Orchestra, very popular band in the early 30s, mid-30s. And Marion ended up with the Glenn Miller Orchestra as their main female singer. And she would sing along with the Modern Airs. And she was on some of the great recordings of World War II.
Wow.
I always called her a shoulder singer because she moves her shoulders a lot when she sings.
Yes.
You know, if you tied up her shoulders, I don't think she could sing. So, and Betty had a little bit of that too. Betty, for me, a little bit goes a long way. She's, I made the mistake once of going to a show called Nuttin' But Hutton, and truer words were never spoken. Betty Hutton's, you know, crazy songs that she does in every movie.
Yep.
It'll always start off very slowly and then it'll go crazy. She did one or two in a movie. This show had like 16 in a row. And by the end of the show, you just wanted to pull your own head off and eat it like an apple, you know, which is impossible. So I tend to lean towards Marion more than Betty, although Betty was really wonderful in the Preston Sturges movie, Miracle in Morgan's Creek. Okay, so Marion does this number. Kirby Grant, who was a child prodigy on the violin. He was born in Butte, Montana in 1911. He was the violinist from his early days. He was quite a singer, very good singer. Was best known for playing Sky King on television. Yeah, and he was celebrated for the rest of his life as someone who helped advance aviation because that show was all about flying.
Yeah.
In fact, the sad story was he had moved to Brevard County, Florida, which is not far from where I am now, for his final years. And he died in a freak car accident as he was driving. And he was on his way to NASA to watch the Challenger go up. And they were paying tribute to him that day. And he died before he got there. So it was very sad. Oh. Sad. This is number 13, kids. I can't help it. This is number 13. So anyway, so there right away, Ann Gillis, who wants to land Kirby Grant because he's very rich. This starts the whole rivalry between her and Marion Hutton. Okay, so this is where the writers come in, and this is wonderful. We went away. We loved the song that she sang, written by Vic Mizzy. Television fans, early television fans.
Oh, yes.
That's Vic. And words by Man Curtis. So they wrote this song and they wrote the other song from this movie, which became a standard, another one from an Abbott and Costello movie. And that's My Dreams Are Getting Better All the Time. And I've got the sheet music hanging on my wall with a beautiful close-up of Bud and Lou. And it became a standard. It became a big, big hit for Doris Day with Les Brown and his orchestra. So here's where the writers won my heart. We go back upstairs to see what's going on in the bedroom and the bathroom. And Thurston Hall hears noises going on, and he gets up out of bed, and he's in 3 feet of water. He doesn't know what the hell's going on. He walks over, he opens the bathroom door, and there is a waterfall of water with Bud and Lou in the bathtub floating out like a boat. And that's what ends the scene there. And it's the perfect way to end it. And the punchline is 10 times better because we had a break in between. Mm-hmm. And this is why Abbott and Costello were so much better than the Three Stooges.
Yeah.
Okay. So, by the way, for Jack Carson fans, of which I am one of the biggest, Marion Hutton also did two seasons of his television show in 1950 and 1951. I just wanted to mention that. And then when she retired from show business, they moved to Washington State, and her and her husband, Vic Schoen, who did the great arrangements for the Andrews Sisters for their Abbott and Costello appearances and most of their recordings. But she got out of the business and she got her master's in psychology and became like a social worker for her final days. Yeah. So quite a woman, rather than losing it and completely going crazy like her sister, who ended up working for priests in a rectory. I don't know if you ever saw that interview with her that Robert Osborne did on TCM. It was her last interview, and she is absolutely out of her mind. You look at her eyes and it's Crazyville. So they fix the plumbing, but tended to destroy parts of the house. And the next day, the Van Cleves are talking about those horrible people that ruined our plumbing and ruined our house, blah, blah, blah. I wrote them a terrible note and I'm going to send it right now. And she's doing it while she's sending out invitations for a weekend at their home where they're going to reveal The Plunger, a painting worth $150,000. And people have to pay $5 a head because it goes to charity. Mm-hmm. And the painting, as my friend Matthew Conium says in his chapter in our book, looks like a magazine ad. It's so bad. It's so, right? It's terrible. Yep. Not yep. that the painting in Animal Crackers is that much better, but this one is just, it really does. It looks like it should be. Smoke Camel cigarettes, which was their sponsor on radio. So anyway, somehow they mix up the invitations and Bud and Lou, rather than getting chastised, they get invited for the weekend. Mm-hmm. Now, they're very excited about this, and they're going to play it to the hilt and hand out business cards, and they're going to be plumbers to society. But first, they have to earn a little money. Now, here's the story behind the Susquehanna Hat Company and Bagel Street. One day, Lou came in and said, "We're doing Flugel Street." And Edmund Hartman said, "What?" He said, "We're going to do Flugel Street." "Yeah, but it doesn't fit. We have it." Okay, Matthew Conium, my buddy, he went in and did the research. It was in the script. Lou didn't come in and say, "This is what I want. This is what I want." It was in the script. Anyway, you know, Bob Fermanek and Ron Palumbo in their book, they also noticed that Edmund Hartman says in his interview that, okay, so we did it quickly. It was just the camera going and they just did it in one take and blah, blah. There were 38 setups for this scene.
Yeah.
So Edmund Hartman, it's like, you know, get a life for crying out loud. It's crazy. So anyway, they do this bit. Now, this is a bit, historically speaking, that first showed its face in 1918. Mm. Now, originally, it was a scene that made sense. There was a strike at the hat company, just as this person has a box full of hats from that company, and they think he's a scab, so they beat him up every time he asks. So it makes perfect sense, right? Mm-hmm. It's just not as funny. So what did Burlesque do? Burlesque cut out the stuff that made sense and just kept the funny. So that's not the end of this. So many people claimed that they wrote this scene or owned this scene, that they purposely kept it quiet, that they were shooting it at Universal. They even changed the name of the Susquehanna Hat Company to the Pioneer Hat Company, which is not funny.
No.
So they went ahead and they did it. And the person who sued them was Joey Fay. Now, Joey Fay, you might know from Mac and Meyer for Hire, Top Banana, great burlesque comic, really a great comic all the way around. I love Joey Fay. Mm-hmm. But he claimed ownership and he copyrighted it 2 years before this. So just he owned the copyright. He didn't write it. He didn't really own it, but he owned the copyright.
Okay.
So he sued everybody. And I believe they settled out of court. He might have made $25,000 or something like that. But anyway, that's what happened with this thing. But it was in the script and it's done beautifully.
Yes.
The guy who wrote the foreword to our book, John Landis, the comedy director, it seems like his entire love affair with Abbott and Costello is based in this routine. He just loves this routine. And I do too. I think it's one of the best things they've done. So basically what this is, if you're not aware of the Susquehanna Hat routine, Bud is asked by their mutual friend, Dan, to take a box full of straw hats from the Susquehanna Hat Company to Bagel Street. And they don't know where it is, and they have to ask people along the way. And one person is crazier than the next. Mm-hmm. Now, this is what happens with Bud and Lou, and this is why I love them so much. When they knew one of their burlesque buddies was in town, they would ask them, what's your specialty? What's the sketch you do best of all? And they would go to the writers. They would go to John Grant and say, so-and-so's in town right now. We could use him in this sketch. Let's put it in the movie. And the guy would get a great check. he would get a scene in a movie and the possibility of more work, all because of their loyalty, Abbott and Costello's loyalty. They didn't forget where they came from. They never did. So in this one, we have Milt Bronson, their buddy, who hurts his thumb during this bit. When he's breaking up the straw hat, a piece of wire goes into his thumb and he goes, ow, and he sucks on the blood on his thumb. And he just keeps going. Oh, I see. You put a wire there just so I'd hurt myself. I see. You know, and he just kept going. I mean, that's beautiful. That's a beautiful thing. And then Elvira Allman, who we all know from Green Acres and Beverly Hillbillies and everything else. She was a regular on the Abbott and Costello radio show. She played their announcer, Ken Niles' wife, and Lou's main enemy. They just insult the hell out of each other. So she comes in and she's great. And then Dorothy Granger, the great two-reeler woman. She usually played Leon Errol's long-suffering wife. She comes in. And then there was a guy by the name of Leon Devon or something like that. I forget. I'm sorry if I forget his name. But he was the one who was in town. He was the one that suggested, you know, I do this. So he was the one at the end that said, the safe fell and killed me. You know, you can't take me away. I'm dead. And then, of course, the great Luis Alberni, the great Spanish actor, came out playing Luigi and gives us our punchline. And that's basically, he goes crazy too and starts breaking up all his crockery with an axe. So Bud and Lou are in crazy land, in crazy burlesque land, ending up owing more money because the hats are all broken. And the next scene we see, they are in a tiny little apartment. Bud's laying on the couch as usual, reading. Lou is dressed up in an apron and a little hat, and he's vacuuming and cleaning and dusting. Suddenly the room moves like it's an earthquake and the camera zips back and we see that they're in the back of a moving truck living in somebody else's furniture. Not only is that wonderful, not only is that a wonderful idea, but when the truck takes off, Bud and Lou end up on the couch, which has rollers on the bottom, and they start this whole scene where the couch is on the loose, going down roads and highways and eventually through a tennis court where they get all tangled up with the net and then they end up in the lake, you know, under the water. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's so random. It's like all of a sudden.
Well, you know, watching it this time is the first time I've made this connection. They're trying to get to this weekend event.
Right.
And they have no way to get there. Right. So here they are in the back of this. I never put that together.
They're traveling.
Until watching it this time. And then when they actually arrive at the house, you see them walking up the drive exhausted.
Right. So, I'm surprised they're not wet, though. You know, I'm surprised they're not dripping. Yeah. But here's the why they're not. Had they done that, you know, it would have been questionable. Why are you all wet?
Yeah.
They had to do this because just before they got there, two guys, one tall and thin, one short and chubby, get out of the car. They're invited. You know, there are two guys, two rich guys, and all of their luggage is taken out of the car. And the butler says, we'll take care of the luggage. So these two guys go in. Bud and Lou end up walking to the place. And Bud gets the idea, let's go through the car here. And they'll think that we were driven. You know, they'll think we're rich. So they do that. And the previous guy's luggage ends up in Bud and Lou's room.
Yep.
And that gives them clothing for the entire weekend. And our two guys who don't have their luggage anymore are off to the side looking at their clothing on other people. I just think that's a wonderful, wonderful thing to throw in to this movie. On top of everything else,
you've
got these two guys. Now, these two guys, the short, fat one is Steven Gerais. Born in Hungary, and he has an incredible resume. Mostly I remember him in Gilda with Rita Hayworth and Glenn Ford. Yeah, he's integral in the movie. In fact, he kills the villain at the end. And he's in a million film noirs and comedies, and he's just wonderful. But the other guy is even more interesting. You know why?
Why?
He was Mickey Dolenz's father, George Dolenz.
Ah,
So he's the dad of a monkey.
Well, I guess that's better than being a monkey's uncle.
So George Dolan's is the other guy, the tall, thin one.
Wow.
And he was also born in Austria-Hungary in Trieste, which is now in Italy. But yeah, he was also Hungarian. So the two of them were pretty much from the same area. And those are our two guys. So we have this wonderful thing where Bud and Lou get this great room. They get this great wardrobe. And they get their own butler. And who plays their own butler but Hollywood's favorite, Arthur Treacher.
Oh, yes. Oh, Arthur Treacher. Love watching him.
And he works great with the guys. He really works great with them. He also has had quite a radio career. He was, in fact, here's the Jack Carson show again. He was Jack's butler on the Jack Carson show. Yeah, they were great together too. But anyway, we all know Arthur Treacher from the fish and chips places. And from what I hear, there are actually two left, one in Ohio, and I forget where the other one is. But yeah, yeah. In fact, I used to go all the time. You put the malt vinegar on the fish. Mm-hmm, oh, mm-hmm. God, it was delicious.
I grew up knowing Arthur Treacher as Merv Griffin's sidekick.
Now, this is very interesting that you bring that up, Jerry, because
yes.
Kevin Brownlow,
oh no,
our friend from across the sea, must have read your mind, because very few people know about this. But when Merv had Arthur Treacher as his sidekick, Arthur got sick one night and called his buddy, Bud Abbott, to come and fill in for him that one night on the Merv Griffin show. And it was a historical night. I mean, really. Bud had just finished doing the cartoons, doing the voices for the cartoons.
Yeah.
And this phone call was something to receive out of the blue, you know? So let's go. He sent me a very short clip of Merv and Bud. So let's take a look at this. Let me just put this in. There we go.
Ooh, this is fascinating. All right. We just got word from Arthur Treacher, our friend Arthur. Ooh, he's fascinating. He's under the weather. Today, he's under the weather. He's under something. Who knows? Mrs. Miller's laughing. I see her. He sent a friend over to replace him, and I'd like to welcome him. He's a very big star. Worked forever with a partner, his little partner, Lou Costello. Please welcome Bud Abbott.
Yay!
Hiya, Bud. Welcome to the show. Quiet. What is with you, Merv? Get out of here. Look at you. My goodness. Have you lost weight? Get out of here. Oh, wait a minute, Bud. Ooh, look at that jacket you're wearing. Ooh, could you open it up and show us the lining? What? The lining, your jacket line. What are you talking about? What are you, nuts? No, listen. Look, you're treating me like Lou. Like who? No, not who, Lou. Lou? You want to go to the bathroom in England? No, Lou. Ooh, that's funny.
And that's all we have. That was the last of the script. Bud didn't make much of an impression. luckily, Arthur Treacher was back the next night. And Bud, from what I hear, he got paid in fish and chips. So that's a very rare clip. We'd like to thank Kevin for that. Thank you.
Well, you'd like to thank Kevin for that. Okay. And on a side note, I would like to say, I've only ever heard one other person do Merv Griffin, and you did it better than him, I will say.
Oh, so. That wasn't me. That was Merv.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yes.
You remember Merv had an airline for a while?
No.
Yeah.
Merv in the air.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I'm serious. It didn't last very long. Okay, so we're away from that now. We have Arthur Treacher.
Yes, and Arthur Treacher.
There's some wonderful dialogue here we should listen to.
Gentlemen, your bath is drawn.
Erase it.
What?
Rub it out.
Shh, not so loud.
My friend is very humorous, too.
You've got to take a bath.
Quiet, not so loud. Right?
Quite.
Right.
Well, sir, if I may start undressing you now.
You're going to undress me?
Yes, sir.
The last person that ever undressed me was my mother, and that was a year ago.
A year ago?
You gotta start to learn undress yourself sometime or other by yourself, don't you?
Right.
Quite.
Right. Ooh. Oh.
That dialogue. I just think it's hilarious.
I was watching this film yesterday, and at that scene, my son came down, passed through the living room, and it stopped him dead in his tracks, that dialogue, because he just thought that was the funniest thing he'd heard in a while.
So, it really is good.
It is.
Really funny stuff. That is funny stuff. And he is just expert. I mean, Arthur Treacher is expert. He was not regarded as Hollywood's butler until he made the Jeeves movie for 20th Century Fox in 1936. Before that, he was showing up everywhere. I remember him in David Copperfield at MGM. He's on screen for like 3 minutes, and he's the one that steals David's money, you know, when David is making his long trek through England. But anyway, Arthur Treacher, hell of a guy. So, okay. So Abbott and Costello have established themselves there as guests at the party. Marion Hutton is, you know, making time with Kirby Grant. In the meantime, Anne Gillis, our 17-year-old rival, is doing a number of her own. It's called Rehearsin', and it was directed by Earl C. Kenton.
Ah.
Yeah. They're not their last director, but the one before that, the one who did all their earliest films. The trouble with In Society was that they had to make it very quickly.
Yeah.
And what they did was they edited it as they shot it. It would go right to the editors because they wanted it finished before the deadline of Lost in a Harem at MGM. So all of this stuff was fielded out to Earl Kenton to do like second unit. So he did this number, and he did the one Kirby Grant does. It's not as good. Change in the Weather. I mean, pretty tune, but not one of my favorites. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Marion Hutton does My Dreams Are Getting Better All the Time. Okay, our villains. Our villains are very good. One is Thomas Gomez. Mm-hmm. Now, Thomas Gomez is another one of those guys who made 8 million movies, playing everything from studio executives to detectives to villains to, you know what I remember him from? I have a thing about heights. When I see in a movie someone fall, you know, a long way, really affects me. I get a little nervous about it. There's a movie called Kim from MGM, 1950, Rudyard Kipling story.
Yes. Yes.
And Thomas Gomez plays a villain who takes Kim, the boy, and I believe it was Bobby Driscoll. Was it Bobby Driscoll? Or one of those child actors, I forget.
Yeah.
But anyway, he's going to push him off the cliff. He's behind him, and he's going to push him off this horrible abyss. Mm-hmm. And before he could do that, Errol Flynn sneaks up behind him and pushes Thomas Gomez. Mm. And as a kid, I put myself in Thomas Gomez's shoes, didn't like them, exchanged them for some sneakers, and then realized how horrible that must have been. Mm-hmm. You think you're going to be pushing someone else, and then all of a sudden you find yourself falling to your doom.
Wow.
Yeah, that's how I remember Thomas Gomez. But anyway, he's our bad guy in this. He loaned the boys $1,000 to start their business, but he had his hooks in them.
Yeah.
Here was the deal. Give me the $1,000 before midnight tonight, or else when you go to the party at the big mansion, you have to let me know what can be stolen. So he wanted them to be part of his illicit stuff.
Yeah.
They don't want to, and they refuse. And Thomas Gomez says, that's okay, don't worry about it. But he sees their picture in the paper at the party. He knows where they are, and he shows up. He wants to steal the plunger, the painting. So he runs into a chauffeur who happens to be parked there when he shows up. And that's Murray Leonard, another great burlesque comedian.
Yep.
Now, Murray shows up in Lost in a Harem. So this was not his first movie with the boys. And he gets to do Slowly I Turned in Lost in a Harem. Yes, with Lou. He also gets the final gag. So they really took care of him. That's for sure. And he gets a great part in here. He's the other crook with Thomas Gomez. And he does the knife throwing thing with Lou in the barn, you know. Mm-hmm. When Thomas Gomez finds out that Bud and Lou still won't help him, he tells Murray Leonard, you know, are you still good with your knives? So Murray takes them into the barn, and they do the old bit where they, again, this is a Stooge thing, you know. The Stooges didn't invent it, but they used it, where you see, it looks like he's throwing the knife, and of course it's coming from behind. The funny thing is the punchline here. Bud knocks out Murray Leonard just as he's throwing the last knife, and you hear it hit, and you hear Lou go, "Whoa," or something. And Bud looks over and says, "Where did he get you?" And Lou says, "In the belt." And you see his pants are down, which is funnier than it sounds, believe me.
Yes, yes.
So they survived that. Now, here is the controversial part of today's show. And again, Matthew Conium wrote the chapter about this. And he mentions the scene where Lou is walking in the backyard by the pool, and a guy falls into the pool and starts screaming that he's drowning. And Lou runs over and he jumps into the pool and he saves the guy. The guy is Don Barclay, a British comedian, one of Cary Grant's best friends, by the way. They knew each other in vaudeville. And he was also one of the top caricaturists in Hollywood at the time. But anyway, he's drowning. Lou saves him. And Bud chastises Lou. It's basically the mustard routine. "Don't you realize that there are families that, you know, that lifeguards have to support, and you're taking the work away from, you know." And then Lou is like, "I'm sorry, I should have let him drown, blah, blah, blah." And the guy solves it by jumping back in. Now, Matthew brings up in the chapter, who thought of this? Right after Lou's son drowns in a pool, who came up with this? Who was cruel enough to come up with this? And Lou does it. Lou didn't say, "What are you doing? You know, this is crazy." He did it, and he did it to the best of his ability. And so did Bud. And so did Don Barclay, of course. Yeah. But it's a good point, Matthew. You've got a good point there. That was very insensitive. It was one of those things that you just have to shake your head and wonder, what the hell were they thinking?
Oh, yeah.
Or not thinking, basically. Yeah, so, it really awful. So, okay, that leads to, let's get down to brass tacks here. The fox hunt, which is one of my favorite sequences because it's pro fox. And I don't mean the network or or any of that. This they go on a fox hunt, and Lou it's just hilarious. He's on a horse, and they come to bridges, and the horse fits right under the bridge, and Lou just walks over the bridge and meets the horse at the other side, jumps down, and they continue. And that happens a couple of times. And they get to the third one. And of course, by the time Lou jumps off the edge of the bridge, it's a bull. And he goes on a wild ride on the back of a bull. The bull throws him, and he catches the fox. And when they catch Lou, there he is petting the fox like a cat, like it's a gentle cat. He got a lot of good press by the animal rights people in those days for letting the fox live. So what a horrible tradition that was, you know. Yeah. Again, our great British friends, they're so caring. So that's that was that. And then they do Change in the Weather, which is kind of a pretty song. Yep. Kind of dull. This is the one I would cut. If I had to cut something, this is the one. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's done. Also directed by Earl C. Kenton, second unit. And okay, this leads us up to our big finale, and this is also a little controversial. Fans of W.C. Fields might remember that his final starring film, Never Give a Sucker an Even Break, was made at Universal. And just like some of his other movies made for Universal, they put chases at the end. Now, it's not exactly what W.C. Fields did, but they work. It's a really wonderful chase at the end of the bank dick. Yeah. It's got a lot of great footage of Fields and great lines coming out of his mouth, so we're not missing anything. Mm-hmm. But then they decided to do it again in Never Give a Sucker an Even Break. Now, this includes his car, includes a fire truck, and it includes most of Los Angeles freeways at the time. And I recognize everyone because I spent most of my life waiting on them. my car. So what they did was, and again, to save time and to get this movie out before MGM's Lost in a Harem, they took the chase from W.C. Fields' film and they redid it. They re-edited it and put Abbott and Costello in instead, along with a fireman, Tom Fadden, who is famous for being the first person killed by the Blob in the movie The Blob. That's how I know him. I can't help it.
Okay.
He's in 8 million movies, but that's the one I remember.
Yep.
He might have also been Superman's father in George Reeves' Superman, the first one.
Oh.
I could be wrong, but I think so. But anyway, so they just edited, they re-edited it. And then some people think it's better this way. And that's because of the stuff Lou is doing. Lou is hanging on that fireman's ladder, and he's doing every shtick in the book.
Yep.
And then the fireman, as he's driving, decides to eat his lunch while he's driving. And Bud is like knocking it out of his hands, and everything he knocks out of his hands goes flying back into Lou's face, all the way back, hanging on for dear life to the ladder. So what happens? At the end of the thing, they crash into the house. They're back at the house, the mansion. The guys are arrested. Bud and Lou have saved the painting. They unroll it. Everybody's happy until the two guys whose clothing they stole finally catch them and say, "You're wearing our clothing. You guys are a bunch of crooks." And they go to push Lou, and Lou goes right through the painting. His head goes right through the painting. So it looks like his head is on the man's body, the plunger. So what do? They end the movie with a two-reeler gag. Now, they did the plumbing scene, which was very reminiscent of two-reeler slapstick. We say the Stooges. The chases in this, you know, are somewhat wild, kind of like what the Stooges did. And then this ending, not only did the Stooges do it a couple of times, but Laurel and Hardy did it like 6 years before in Swiss Miss.
Yep.
When a gorilla throws a crutch at them. I'll let you think about that. Gorilla throws a crutch at them. What, he's going to throw a wheelchair or a walker? He threw Ray Walker. But anyway, these two guys see Bud and Lou running off in the distance. And I mean in the distance. And you barely see them. They're running so far away. They're barely at the edge of the screen. And these two guys pick up two rocks and they throw the rocks. And you hear, and then a clunk. And the two guys are hit by the rocks and they collapse. And that's the end of the movie. And to be honest with you, it works. It really works.
For me, my main questions was, okay, Bud and Lou run out of the building and mm-hmm. the two guys are almost on their heels.
Yes.
And then the next time we see them, the two guys are standing there and Bud and Lou are like 12 miles away. How the heck did they get all the way? Anyway.
Okay. To me, that makes sense, by the way. It just shows you how quickly they wanted to get away.
I'll buy that. My second most favorite line in this movie, you know, I've already told you my most favorite. My second most favorite comes right after Lou pokes his head through the painting. And you get that shot of the painting with his head sticking through. And it's guys playing poker. They're gambling.
Right.
And Lou looks down at the painting and says, "The guy on the left is cheating."
I love that. One more joke before the final gag, right?
Yes.
My favorite line from the movie, and this made me, I guffawed. That's how much I laughed, is when Thomas Gomez comes in first time to the plumbing shop and is threatening them, right? And Lou says, "What happens if we can't pay you the $1,000? And he picks up this round glass ball and he says, "Well, I could see into the future. And I see two guys here floating down the river." And Lou says, I got news for him. I can't swim. Which, again, is another uncomfortable joke under the circumstances. But
yes.
I think it's so funny that he threatens to drown them. And Lou is like, "Oh, the joke's on him. I can't swim." Now, I wanted to discuss, go back, and just before we finish up today, the whole thing about Lou and mm-hmm. how he changed and how his performances changed. I heard from somebody today, a good friend of mine wrote when I mentioned that we were going to do In Society today. He said, "You know, I have trouble with those movies, the ones after Lou Jr. died." Mm. He says, I just don't think they're sticking to the formula too long. They should have gone other places. I think they weren't really worth watching again until Little Giant, when they actually did change things up. And I told him, I said, "No, I don't agree. These movies, this one, Here Come the Coeds, mm-hmm. Naughty 90s, every single one of them are gems. Every single one of them are entertaining films. They may not have the same energy or the same surprises that the other ones had. That's the main thing, I think. There weren't many surprises left from Bud and Lou. It had to be good, strong material. But these movies had it. These movies had good, strong material. And I can't wait to get to them. So, and we'll point all of that out. So that's it. Any closing remarks, Jerry, you'd like to make?
Try not to talk about clothes. So
I'm looking at your wardrobe and I understand.
There you go.
That's... seriously, that's a very nice shirt. And I didn't realize Paisley was back.
And it's on the front, too. Anyway.
But enough about war.
But yes, just picking up on what you just shared there, I have to agree that this section of films here, probably starting with Hit the Ice and moving on to the next few, some of my favorite of their entire output, because they do have a spark. They do have an energy. Yes, perhaps there's not as much ad-libbing going on. There's not as much spontaneity going on, but they still work. They still, Bud and Lou deliver.
Yes.
And like you mentioned in this one, Bud especially,
God,
really steps up.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And you could see the way I discerned it, or the way I figured it, he was there to support his partner. He was there. He knew his partner went through hell, and he was there holding more than holding up his end, and did so for the rest of their careers, basically.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't see much of a difference as far as these films are concerned. Yes, I think Matthew's point of not having as many surprises, you know, they weren't new anymore.
Yeah.
But they were still popular as ever. A year being away for a year, and 1944 only having two movies as opposed to their 9,000, they still came in number three at the box office in the top 10. So the boys were there, and they were heading for, again, new ground under different circumstances, and we are going to cover every stinking last movie that they made. And we've been hearing some wonderful things. I want to thank Nicholas Demetrio, I believe his name was, for a wonderful review. And people have just been saying such really nice things, other than this one guy. I'm not going to mention name, but he did take umbrage at the Bud Abbott comical things that I add. Unfortunately, he's one in like 1,000 that doesn't like it. So I'm sorry, we're going to chip in and buy you a sense of humor, and we'll go from there. So anyway, that's it. That's about all I've got to say. Our next film is going to be back at MGM. We're going to be looking at Lost in a Harem, where the boys are again up against the great Douglas Dumbrill.
Yes.
And we'll go into that in a couple of weeks. And Jerry, I, as always, I could just say that this is the highlight of my week, and I always look forward to this.
As do I, my friend. It's entertaining, it's educational, and quite honestly, I almost feel like I'm in a kind of a wasteland here in Spokane, Washington. Not a whole lot of people share my passion for some of these old movies, so it's always a thrill to chat with you.
Thank you. Thank you, Jerry. And you listen, this is the interesting thing for me. I'm taking care of my mom. She's 93 years old. And the people in the building where we are basically older than I am. And they don't know who the hell I'm talking about. They have no idea. I mean, they've heard of Abbott and Costello. They know about it. But let's face it, Jerry, it is a very diminishing interest amongst our generation. We are the last that really, really care about these films and really love looking at them and studying them and laughing at them and appreciating them. We are a very small group. We are a niche group. And let's just carry on and take one for the team, you know? Ooh, hear that bell go off? That means it's time for me to go back for round four against Tony Montana. Here we go. All right. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. All right, everybody. Take care. We'll see you in a couple of weeks, and we will talk about Lost in a Harem. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.